Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by the inimitable Gordon Chang, our duty expert and that of much of the free world, it turns out, on matters involving Asia and our security interests there. He is the author of two important books, one, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, the other, The Coming Collapse of China. He is a contributor to The Daily Beast and Fox News and to our programs in a very big way. We're always pleased to have him with us. Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Where to begin, Gordon? I guess the story du jour is North Korea. It seems as though the charm offensive is back on. The North Korean parade in the streets of Pyongyang decidedly lowballed, we're told, the nuclear threat capabilities that North Korea has been amassing, specifically the longer-range missiles capable of attacking the United States, in favor of a lot of other goose-stepping officers and the like. But, Gordon, what are we to read into, if anything, these kinds of posturings by the North Korean regime?
As you point out, the Foundation Day parade on Sunday did not include ICBMs. And also the mass games that were held yesterday did not include any reference to those missiles. I think there's two things. You know, people talk about how this is an attempt to try to continue the discussions with President Trump. And I think that that's right. The North Koreans want to stall. They're getting everything they want right now. So they have really no motivation to provoke. But also the other story here is that Kim Jong-un wants to entice his South Korean counterpart, President Moon Jae-in. They're going to have a summit starting on the 18th of this month. And clearly, Kim wants Moon to, first of all, shovel a lot of money into his hands, but also to agree to some sort of unification of the two Koreas, probably a confederation of one country, two governments, if you could call it that. But clearly, I think Kim has Moon on his mind as well as President Trump.
Well, so let's talk about President Moon. Gordon, you have observed that he's not necessarily playing for our team, and he has surrounded himself, I'm told by one of our colleagues, Lawrence Peck, with substantial numbers of really dyed-in-the-wool pro-North Korea leftists. And this may well be contributing to the establishment of, among other things, a liaison office that will serve as some sort of vehicle for effecting the kind of interface and perhaps ultimately unification that you've just discussed. Should President Trump and his team be concerned that our ally in Seoul ain't necessarily much of an ally anymore?
Yeah. President Trump should be extremely concerned about Moon Jae-in and his close-in advisors because Moon is pro-North Korean and largely because he sees the most important thing in the world is not North Korea giving up its arsenals, but unifying the two Koreas into one. And so he's willing to make many compromises that undermine not only American positions on nukes, but also good order in the region. So you're talking about the liaison office at the Kaesong Industrial Complex, just north of the Demilitarized Zone. If that complex were to be reopened, it would be a substantial win for Kim, because when it was opened, it shoveled about $95 to about $100 million a year into the coffers of the North Korean regime. There was about 125 light manufacturers from South Korea there. This would just blow a hole through the sanctions regime, which is already in deep trouble right now. So clearly, the United States needs to stop this opening of the liaison office. We think it's a sanctions violation. Moon, of course, does not. We need to put the hard word in on Seoul.
This, again, is symptomatic of a larger policy approach, Gordon. How would unification work in the eyes of these pro-North Korean folks in South Korea? Is it that they will essentially submit to the machinations and mechanisms of the government of North Korea, or that will govern part of the country and they will govern the other part? Is it clear how this thing could be operationalized without it being a complete capitulation on the part of the South Koreans?
Well, the North Koreans have been talking about confederation since the time of regime founder Kim Il-sung. And the idea would be, the first step would be to essentially have two separate governments for a single unified Korean state. One of those governments based in Pyongyang, the other, of course, in Seoul. But I think that essentially what we would see as a practical matter is the North taking over the South. And the reason is that, at least under the Moon administration, they don't really believe in democracy. We are seeing a constriction of freedom of speech right now in South Korea. So although most South Koreans don't want this, most South Koreans don't count right now, because it is Moon driving this political process, and he's also driving unification moves. So right now, this is an extremely dangerous time. You know, a lot of people in America think that, and they've thought for a long time, that it's just ludicrous of North Korea taking over South Korea. But unfortunately, at this moment, that's more probable than South Korea taking over the North.
Yeah. Gordon, in the past, if I recall correctly, the South Korean military was a break on this kind of craziness. Is there any prospect that the military forces or leadership in the South today would play that kind of role now, even to the point of insisting that the government return to a more democratic practice, even if it's through a coup?
A coup is unlikely, but we've got to be concerned about what Moon is doing to the military. He has plans to substantially reduce its size, and he also has plans to reduce the period of conscription. He is removing barbed wire and guard posts along the demilitarized zone, and tank traps are actually being dismantled, according to rumors. So this looks like an attempt to make the South Korea open to military attack from the North. And we got to remember that President Trump has suspended the large-scale military exercises, which means the readiness of the Combined Forces Command is eroding. And at the same time, the North Koreans are continuing with their large-scale exercises this summer training cycle. So this is a time of peril. No one really thinks at this point that North Korea will invade, but South Korea is making itself open to military intimidation by these developments, those in Beijing.
Fascinating and deeply troubling stuff. Gordon Chang, as always, we're very grateful to you for your insights, as well as those that you share with the larger public through, among other things, The Daily Beast and Fox News. I look forward to talking with you again next week, hopefully with a little cheerier report. Next up, Thomas Homan, the former acting director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, joins us to talk about the important role it plays and why it must not be abolished. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We've been joined by Hans von Spakovsky, one of our duty experts on, well, a whole host of very interesting subjects, as it turns out. His background is, of course, in the law. He is a veteran of the George W. Bush Justice Department, where he served in the senior ranks as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He is these days a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He has served as a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission and is the author of two books, co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, and Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. Hans, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm wanting to talk with you about several things, so we're going to move through this with dispatch. First up, I'd like to get your sense, as a man who has served in government, of what we are to make of, well, what I think of as kind of a concerted political warfare operation against the president, not simply what Anonymous or what the Woodward Books contributors have told them about what they're doing to his presidency, but the very fact that these reports are outing at this moment in the election cycle. Your thoughts?
Well, it's an unfortunate problem that Republican presidents have. I mean, this president has it worse than others, but all of them face this problem. I saw it during the Bush administration of people inside the government, what everybody these days refers to as the swamp, who don't like the president, who don't like his priorities, don't like his policies, and think that in their government jobs that they have the right and duty to do everything they can to thwart what the president is doing. And it wasn't just career civil service people that I saw doing that. But, you know, I also saw, frankly, occasionally political appointees inside the Justice Department who felt that way. They were more interested, Frank, in making sure that people on the left, people in the media were happy with them because of that they thought guaranteed their future job prospects, than necessarily making the White House happy.
Yeah, or doing the bidding of the duly elected president of the United States. And Hans, to what extent do you think this is more acute a problem because Donald Trump, as a non-politician, essentially came to office without a cadre of people to populate the senior ranks of his administration? He's had a very difficult time getting people in. And as you say, to some extent, it seems at least, in addition to the Obama holdover problem, he's had appointees who simply aren't with his program, whether they favor, as Anonymous apparently does, the policies of John McCain or something else. They are sort of considering themselves free agents. It does seem as though it's worse than Bush.
Oh no, it's much worse because Donald Trump, he's the first president, I think actually since Ronald Reagan, to shake things up. To say, no, we need to deregulate. I mean, we need to take all these steps like enforcing our immigration laws. It's all stuff that disrupts the traditional Republicans in this town who always have been go along to get along because, again, they don't want to do anything that upsets the editorial page of the Washington Post and might upset their future job prospects when they return to private industry or their private law firms from government.
And the practical effect really is that their behavior, their policy approach, their preferences, their counter-disruption, if you will, their resistance, has a lot more in common with the Democratic opposition to this president than it does to, needless to say, the president, or for that matter, the substantial number of Americans who made him president of the United States. One of the most consequential things, of course, that he has been getting done, as you know so well, Hans von Spakovsky, is appointing conservatives to the federal bench. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about Judge Kavanaugh's experience on Capitol Hill last week and offer the thought that it's really drove home to me, and I'm sure to many others, the point that here you have not only an extraordinary and very experienced and accomplished jurist, but you have kind of an all-American guy with his, you know, background and his love of his family and his commitment to their sports activities and his service to the community and so on, in sharp contrast to the Colin Kaepernicks and the Social Democrats, much in evidence on that committee, the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, to say nothing of Linda Sarsour, the Sharia supremacist who was thrown out and arrested for her demonstrating, among others. Talk us through where the Kavanaugh nomination is as you see it and the insights that we might take from his experience up on the Hill last week.
Well, it was quite a contrast, wasn't it? Despite the fact that he's probably one of the most qualified individuals ever nominated to the Supreme Court.
As even the ABA, the American Bar Association, hard to the left, was obliged to acknowledge.
Yeah, no, they gave him, you know, they've been accused, rightfully, of bias against conservatives in recent years in their rating system. And even they unanimously gave him their highest qualification. And yet he had to undergo character assassination and attacks, constant disruptions from protesters at the hearing who were commended for what they were doing by Dick Durbin and Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, contrast their behavior with his, and it's quite something.
Their behavior and as well Dick Durbin and his colleagues' behavior, for that matter.
Yeah. Trying to obstruct it and not allowing the hearing to go forward. Well, there were 4 days of hearing. He unfortunately had to sit through 3 days of it. The fourth day was 28 witnesses, and again, the witnesses really tell you a lot. The Democrats, if you can believe this, brought in 3 teenagers, including a 13-year-old, to testify against this well-known appellate court judge. I mean, we're supposed to go on what a 13-year-old tells us about who should sit on the Supreme Court and who's the best expert on constitutional law in the country. I mean, it shows how these have turned into a circus. And quite frankly, I almost felt like I was in a time warp and I was in Moscow in 1937 watching a show trial, the kind that Stalin put on, because that's what the Democrats try to do with this. The hearing's over. This Thursday is the business meeting of the Judiciary Committee where they would normally have a vote. The Democrats, under the rules, however, have the ability to table the nomination for a week without any reason or questions asked. So I suspect it'll be 2 weeks before he's voted out of the committee. I'm sure it'll be a party line vote, and then he'll be on the floor.
Mm. And then we'll hopefully see him become Justice Kavanaugh. Let me lastly ask you about one other thing, calling back to your experience on the Federal Elections Commission, as well as the research that you and John Fund and Christian Adams and others have done on election law and violations thereof, Hans von Spakovsky. There was a case in Michigan in which an appellate court made a ruling that seemed to be pretty bracing from the side of those of us who believe that election law integrity is important and it needs to be enforced. Talk a little bit about that case and more broadly, if you would, how things are shaping up as you see it for a fraud-free election in this November.
Yeah, Michigan joined the vast majority of states who don't have what's called straight ticket voting. For folks who haven't heard of it, well, there's a good reason, because most states in the country don't allow it. Straight ticket voting in Michigan was when you went in to vote on the ballot, there was actually a box up at the top of the ballot for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And rather than having to make a choice in each race, you could just check the Republican box or the Democratic box, and it automatically it gives a vote for every candidate for that party on there. Michigan got rid of it. They joined the 40 other states that don't have it. And a liberal group went to court and claimed that this was discriminatory and it violated the Constitution, if you can believe that. That forcing voters to make an individual choice in elections is somehow discriminatory, if you can believe this. It was an absurd lawsuit. And yet it got assigned to, no surprise, Frank, an Obama judge. And the Obama judge said, oh, yeah, this is discriminatory. And the fact that, according to the state, a voter might have to spend an extra 3 minutes in the polling place, well, that's a violation of the Constitution.
Well, this really does give new meaning to the whole idea of sort of dumbing down democracy, does it not?
Yeah. So he'd issued a permanent injunction against the law, but the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals just issued a stay of it. So in the November election in Michigan, you will not be able to engage in straight ticket voting.
Good. And more generally, Hans, there's a lot of reporting suggesting that motor voter registration and same day of voter registration and the like are really contributing to significant voter fraud. You participated in a somewhat aborted effort on the part of Donald Trump to investigate such things. What's your current rating of the prospects for this election being, well, manipulated or otherwise, you know, influenced by such events?
Well, unfortunately, what is going to happen in this upcoming election is that people who aren't U.S. citizens are going to be voting all over the country. And the reason for that is that there's been numerous reports out recently about the fact that many states are not catching and, in fact, are contributing to the problem of non-citizens who go in to get driver's licenses. So here we're talking about actually people who are here legally, but they're not citizens, who are also registering to vote when they get their driver's licenses. And election officials are just letting it happen.
Hans von Spakovsky, thanks for the work you do at the Heritage Foundation, as well as your very distinguished public service over the years. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, I'm happy to say, by Robert Charles. He is a man you frequently see at Fox, and you probably are reading his writings at foxnews.com and elsewhere. He is also a former Assistant Secretary of State, having had in the George W. Bush administration the portfolio of international narcotics and law enforcement affairs. He's a former naval intelligence officer, a litigator. He served in both the Reagan and Bush 41 White Houses. He's taught at Harvard. He is a man, in short, of many parts, not least of which, of course, is as a new and successful, I'm pleased to say, author of a new and very compelling book, Eagles and Evergreens. Robert Charles, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I'd like to touch base with you about two topics that we've talked about earlier in the program with other guests. I spoke with the former counsel to an assistant attorney general under the George W. Bush administration, namely Hans von Spakovsky, about this whole phenomenon of Bob Woodward's book about the Trump White House and this seemingly synchronized, unsigned editorial by Anonymous in the New York Times. And I wanted to get your take, Robert Charles, as a veteran of White Houses and administrations more generally, of whether what's described here is all that extraordinary in terms of individuals working out their own agenda rather than that of the president. And whether, as I tend to think, this has a lot more to do with political warfare against this president in the midst of a hotly contested election season as much as anything else. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so several observations, Frank. And I think having worked in the Reagan and Bush White Houses and actually also in Colin Powell's Department of State, I will tell you that right off the top, first, it is not at all uncommon that you find these people who have their own personal agendas that are trying to run their own personal agendas, either for their own ego or because they politically are opposed to a president's agenda. And I had to constantly, as an assistant secretary of state, with the full support of Colin Powell, who was very supportive of George W. Bush, we had to constantly ferret out, redirect, try to remotivate, occasionally penalize people who really weren't pursuing the president's agenda. Point two is there's no question in this instance, this is really it comes down to the difference between, I guess I'll say, the substantive things this White House and president are doing and the political chaw that the insiders, the game players, the Woodwards of the world really just want to chew on and get the political elites to chew on. It's like candy for them. To me, it's not significant. The big significant things that happened this week were Kavanaugh did an just an exceptional job, distinguishing himself as a great jurist, as well as a great and thoughtful, frankly, conversationalist with people who aren't very conversational. He was able to put forward a political philosophy that makes a lot of sense. Many of us knew it did beforehand, but and incidentally, as well as his integrity and credentials. Interestingly, in that case, the contrast between a real professional who is serving the higher interests with a philosophically consistent approach to life and the opposition was really stark. I think the Bookers of the world versus Kavanaugh, just extraordinarily stark. The second big thing I'll say about this week is, you know, the economy continues to roar. And in the end, this coming election is really about a great economy that is continuing to serve every single American well. You know, black, white, green, it doesn't really matter. The bottom line is every demographic is being supported by this president and this economy versus the idea of impeachment, which is really the offstage player here, where if the Democrats were to control the House, they would really like to impeach this president, which, as we know from living through a couple of impeachment proceedings, is a tremendous downdrag on everybody. And even if you believed that for some reason this was going to come out of the House, it would never go anywhere in the Senate. So it's a tremendous downdrag on the economy and a number of other things, including internal morale. On the letter itself, it's very clear. I mean, if this happened in the military, a White House, anywhere else in the world, I mean, and it has just happened, the point is this person should resign. You always have a choice, right? If you don't agree with the president, your job is not whether you took the constitutional oath, which actually it used to be every federal employer took. Now it's just the more senior ones, but it's implicit in their contract. If you ultimately disagree with a president, you should resign. And that's a straightforward, high integrity position. Anything else is less than high integrity. Indeed, it lacks integrity.
It does lack integrity, and it is subversive, really, of our democratic process, whereby we elect a commander in chief, and he is supposed to be faithfully followed by the executive branch in the execution of lawful orders.
And to one last point there, and that is, I do believe that there is not only a right, but an obligation to internally, I don't care what they do externally, but to find this individual and anyone else who incidentally has this agenda, and to simply say, look, you've breached your obligation to the president, to this administration, and you're fired. And that's it.
Well, we will be watching this one closely. Let me turn quickly to another topic that came up in our conversation with Gordon Chang. And again, we're speaking with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State. Robert, Gordon was warning, really, of some very ominous developments on the Korean Peninsula, not simply those of the abiding threat from North Korea, but from the practices of the South Korean government that seem to be aimed not simply at propping up the North Korean regime and returning to the so-called sunshine policy of previous leftist South Korean governments, but actually putting South Korea at risk, nominally in the idea of unifying under terms that would be satisfactory to the North, but perhaps teeing up the possibility of who knows, even an invasion by the North. What is your thought on all of that?
Well, first of all, I think that the South Korean people should be watching closely, and I'm sure they are. These are democratic, capitalist, thoughtful, and pretty circumspect population. Moon Jae-in is a change from the historic South Korean conservatism. And, I will say this, and with great caution, I don't disagree with anything your prior guest had to say, and I agree with you, Frank. There is great caution here. Big change always engenders big risk. And the risk, of course, is that you are going to somehow lose control of a process that you've initiated. The president, in this case, probably ought to be encouraging an allied huddle in the Far East, where it's made clear that no back steps by South Korea, not only are they not advisable, but they would have consequences. There are trade consequences and other things involved here, security consequences. I think to underestimate the manipulation or the potential manipulation and the historic manipulation of both the North Koreans and the Chinese would be dangerous. At the same time, I think we do have an historic opportunity created by this president. And what would I do? I would say that the State Department needs to keep heavy pressure on China, overt daily, regular, consistent, to keep the sanctions on. The same thing with South Korea. Make clear that there are exit ramps that are simply closed. This is not the opportunity for some bleary-eyed reunification moment. The reunification is a distant possibility, in the same way that when East Germany eventually came apart under the strong pressure, guidance, encouragement, and unified approach of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. In the end, things ended up free, more democratic, and capitalist, and you had integration. The way to integrate that peninsula is never going to be to bring the repressive policies of the North, never mind their army, south. It is to bring democracy, freedom, human rights, and a sense of a positive future north. So what I think President Trump is seeking to do, and what we have to keep our laser light on, is making this North Korean leader see that there are tremendous penalties to pay if he goes in the wrong direction. Moon needs to see that there are similar but perhaps lesser penalties to be paid if they in turn kind of get off the track. And then at the same time, to empower Kim Jong-un, to try to empower him to be a transformational leader. You know, Gorbachev was the transformational leader that Reagan encouraged in the former Soviet Union. And I think, you know, the goal here is to give this enough incentives to Kim that he says, you know, it doesn't make any sense. There are risks involved in anything I do. The missile launches, this stuff could get me obliterated. I think I need to go in the direction of opening the door. And that would be the direction forward.
We'll be hoping for that and hopefully working for it. And Robert Charles, we'll look forward to talking with you about that and much more in the days ahead. Thank you for your time today. Congratulations again on the publication of Eagles and Evergreens. And again, our appreciation for your service to our country. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.